So you'll literally go into this closet under the stairs, and then you'll be like, this Friday, you know, summer heats up, and you know, and then you'll just be talking in the hallway, and then a door will just open. Shut up, I'm trying to record here.
In a world where you only have trailers and posters to judge a movie, Jim and Ted strike out to answer the age-old question, will you see it?
Hey, Ted, it's Jim. How are you this week?
Good.
Nice. And we have John Cantu with us. He's a trailer editor who's done a few things just recently.
That's right. He's the editor of my favorite trailer from 2018, the highest opening weekend for an original horror film, Jordan Peele's Us. But this isn't John's first rodeo. He's been motion picture advertising for over a decade, including trailers for Pacific Rim Uprising, Get Out, Nightcrawler, and TV campaigns for Fate of the Furious and Jason Born, among others. John's ethos for storytelling, regardless of the form or format, is something we trailer junkies love. Welcome, John.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Hey, we love having you here. So in typical trailer junkies fashion, we like to talk about, like, you know, maybe our week and just things we've been doing and so on. But, you know, the other thing we like doing too is opening a beer before. And I heard we're all doing stouts this week or something.
We are doing stouts this week.
At my request, and I highly appreciate you adjusting for my tastes.
I accommodate all beer requests, you know?
And I don't think there's any adjusting needed because we just love stouts too. So what do you guys, are you guys sharing the same beer then? Or do you guys have different beers? How did you guys set it up?
Well, I went down to, normally you go to Handy Market in Burbank, but this week I did Whole Foods, and the guys over at the Burbank Whole Foods, Ryan and Steve, were great over there. They hooked us up with the St. Peter's Cream Stout. They're fun oval bottles.
I was about to say, this looks like a bottle of like hard liquor.
Like a little Mad Dog 2020 a little bit in the nice. The hand feel.
It looks really, I mean, it looks very elegant. It's not it's not what I'm, you know, used to.
It has like an embossed, like how would you call that? The logo of the brewery?
Yeah.
So St. Peter's Brewery is a good enough a blind person could read it with their fingers, and then has a nice, just a simple little oval circle here.
And it's from the UK.
There you go.
So do you, John, you want to open? You want to do the honors?
Yeah. So I guess I put this up to the mic. I listened to the one with Marcos, and it seemed like that was the way to do it. Yeah. Ready? Here we go. Yeah. Oh.
All right. Nice.
Kind of hit the floor. All right. And let's get this professional pour on. Tilt the glass a little bit.
Ooh. And Ted, you got these at Handy Market, you said?
No, I went to Whole Foods this week.
Oh, Whole Foods. Okay. Oh, wow, Whole Foods. Must be healthy beer.
Always.
Oh, that looks delicious.
I love the tulip that you have there.
Yeah, I think we all have tulips, don't we? What are you That's drinking right. it out of there, Ted?
Same.
Aha, nice.
I have my Carmelite tulip.
Oh, I was considering that, but I went with, what is a Duvel, but it's going to be a stout this week. Mine, I bartered beer for bike repair. So when I was in college undergrad, I wrenched in a bike shop for about 6 years. And guy I work with, he also listens to the podcast and everything. And he was telling me about how his bike was in pieces in the garage. I said, well, you know, get me some beer and I'll put it together for you. So from what he was saying is that the store probably recommended these nuts, but I think he misunderstood and he got, you know, these nuts.
Oh, wow. So, that's an actual beer name.
Yeah, the name of the beer is These Nuts. It's a Belgian. I can't even read the back of it. I had to look it up and then translate it earlier today. But it's a Belgian English oatmeal stout that's 12%. So I'm going to share some of this with my wife, because if I drink this whole thing, I'm just going
to
be like...
I was about to say, this will be a 15-minute podcast.
Yeah, I'll be falling out of my chair. Yeah. But anyway, here we go. So... Uh-oh, I don't know. Let's see what it does. Oh, my goodness. Wow, that smells amazing.
Oh, look at the acoustics on that.
Yeah, it's like chocolate milk. Mm. All right. I'll give her a little bit too, just so she has a taste. And
so, John, have you taken a sip?
I have. It's I can't like go all Paul Giamatti and sideways on you, but it's delicious. I think I love cream stouts. I can't like intellectualize it in any form or fashion.
I agree with you. I think cream stouts, they're smooth, they're mellow, you know, and that's this, you know, it's as far as diversity among cream stouts, I think that's why I'm an IPA guy, because IPAs are just like so verbally, you know, like individual. So you could always find a little something to say about IPAs and cream stouts. This is a good one. Like, that's all I can say about this.
What's the alcohol content? 6.5.
6.5, yeah.
Yeah, this is like earthy hazelnut.
Oh, your oatmeal stout there?
Yeah, like you don't even know. Like, it's way too drinkable for a 12%er. It could get you in trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is like...
yeah. Clarissa agrees.
Those are the ones you have to watch out for. those are the ones you definitely share with the wife.
Yeah, exactly.
Give her more than a sip. Come on. That's so crazy.
Little taster. Love it. Love it.
So Ted, how was your week this week?
Good week. Yeah, I saw Us last night and it blew me away. I wrote a review about it on Letterboxd last night right when I got home, and then I did some dishes, and then at midnight I woke up and I was like, oh, something, it actually meant this. And then I rewrote the review, and then this morning I woke up and I was like, well, actually it had more dimensions to it than that. And I wrote yet another Twitter review that was separate from my Letterboxd. So it's definitely taken me on like three different rides.
And it's not
so
going to stop for like the next 4 months. Just get ready. Yeah. That's like now it's great, because now everybody in America is invited to my little personal internal discussion that I've been having for all these months when I've been working on this thing.
That's the way I ended it. I was like, I just want to talk to people about this. You know, everyone that I've seen that has seen it in my office, or my friends that have seen it, are all saying like, I need to see it again. I need to see it again. And to me, it actually is like, it's more about just I've internalized it, and I went into it with such high expectations that I was like trying to pick up the nuance of each piece of symbolism and each thing that was, you know, nothing is wasted. He's a very economical auteur. So I could see where I could, you know, I tried to imagine where he was going to take something, and there's no Chekhov's gun, you know, nothing's not utilized in the cinematic space that he uses. So it was beautiful. And it, to me, it paid out. It paid off on every level. Some other friends, some Twitter friends, they take issue a little bit with the script, but I'm always looking at it from a producer's perspective, which is as a whole. So I don't get hung up on plot points or too much exposition or too little exposition. I think he left some things unexplained, which is even better, because it's like you're going to get caught down the rabbit hole, pun intended.
Nicely done.
With trying to over-explain tethering or some aspect of this film, and just don't go there. You know, it's not a piece that's important to the core structure of the movie. So,
well, John, you mentioned that, you know, the rest of the country is now like involved in your internal conversation that you've been having. Like, how long does it take to put together a trailer for, you know, a movie like Us? Like, how long has the internal conversation been going, essentially?
It continues going even after your first version. And I mean, I think what's kind of wild as a trailer editor is when you see a movie, what you're seeing is an artistic process that's happened, but not just with the director, but with an editor, producers, a marketing department, test screenings, test results, reshoots. I mean, it's basically the end of a long journey. And that journey is very, very seldom done by the time that I start working on the trailer. And so that conversation is, I mean, quite honestly, kind of still going on in my head. The thing is, we're still not done with the campaign, because this was, you know, the number one movie in America. And it's looking like, you know, it's probably going to be number two this weekend. Based on, you know, how certain holds happen. But you're still thinking about, how do I keep presenting this singular piece of work to the country? And what am I going to be asked by, you know, the marketing team upstairs to take on? What's going to happen during award season? These are all, you know, things that keep circulating in my brain. And on Get Out, it was one of those things, you know, where the discussion that you're having very early on while you're doing the trailer may not be the same discussion, you know, 5 months to a year down the road when everybody knows it and now you're representing it as, you know, an artistic achievement. I mean, I'm sorry, that's kind of a long-winded...
No, it's podcasting. It's supposed to be long-winded.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. But so, I'm in the profession of really cutting things down.
Do they have you working on, or do they say, generally speaking, you know, an FYC campaign, a For Your Consideration campaign, an awards campaign? They're doing it at the same time as they're doing the regular wide release.
With a couple exceptions. I mean, so Get Out was a very special case because I think everybody from the get-go knew that they had something really special on their hands. I don't think anybody really knew that it was going to, you know, be so critically acclaimed that a year later we'd be talking about Oscars. But I think pretty early on, when we started the campaign for the Academy stuff and, you know, for awards, things had changed. You know, it was like the Get Out Challenge. A lot of cultural input had kind of happened around the movie. The fan art for Get Out, you know, was incredible. And, you know, it happened after the movie was released that people realized that, oh my God, Jordan gets me. Jordan gets this. Jordan is an important voice in the social conversation. And, you know, that was kind of cool to see people like artistically respond to what he did. And with their own art, you know, elements of that actually got incorporated into our For Your Consideration campaigns.
That's cool.
To the point that, you know, with us, we actually got a little ahead of that. Because as soon as we dropped the trailer, people were, you know, doing paintings. They were doing all kinds of art pieces based around the trailer. And we were able to use those like in a TV spot. So, I mean, there are elements of the general campaign that might carry over to the, you know, For Your Consideration campaign. But, I mean, they're kind of fundamentally trying to achieve two different goals. Your general campaign is just trying to get people excited to go to the theater.
Right.
And then For Your Consideration campaign is to zero in on the things for, you know, voters that make it an artistic achievement. And those don't line up as much as you would think. I think, you know, I think it's the difference between your average moviegoer who just wants to go to the movies to have a fun time. And then, your filmmaking podcasters,
right?
You know, who are like, this is important. The
industry folks. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you know, it's kind of like two different demographics, and you kind of have to change your brain a little bit when you do one type of campaign to when you do the other.
So, John, how involved is the director in the trailer editing versus the freedom you have for your own artistic impression?
It varies from filmmaker to filmmaker. I mean, those battles, you know, if they become battles, are not necessarily had by me. Those are had by like producers and marketing departments to be like, no, we believe that this is the best way forward for your film and so forth. So they're not always in the bay with you. Although I definitely have had that happen on occasion where, you know, a director or a star or a producer or somebody will come in to, you know, put their two cents in.
Like looking over your shoulder, you mean? Or?
Oh, yeah.
Like literally looking over your shoulder?
Oh, yeah. I mean, kind of saying, well, I think this is cool or that's not cool. And that's actually, it's been some of the more rewarding moments of my career have actually happened in cases like that, where I've had, you know, a director kind of tell me, oh, take a look at this, take a look at that. I actually was lucky enough several years ago, Ryan Coogler, you know, who went on to do, you know, Creed and yeah. Panther. I was working on a trailer that didn't ultimately finish. It wasn't the one chosen, but I was working on a trailer with him for Fruitvale Station, his first movie. And, you know, he kind of stopped the film for a second. He's like, you want to see something that'll trip you out? And it's one of the scenes where Michael B. Jordan, you know, gets on the BART, and then the BART's, mm-hmm. You know, goes down the track, and there's all these people that you see. And he tells me, only the people that you see when he got on, the rest of those are just, they're fake. Like that's all a visual effect. Yeah, yeah, crazy, right?
That's awesome.
Yeah, because I mean, my mind was like, how did you make this masterpiece, Fruitvale Station, for like under $1 million?
So So I think that brings up a good question then. So like you kind of see how the sausage is made. And then when the movie comes out and you see the process of what goes on and everything, I mean, is there, you know, because you've been so much involved with seeing the pre-production and the production and putting it together and all the stuff that goes on, by the time you go see it in the theater, if you do, I mean, I guess you would do, but by the time you go see it in the theater, is it one of those things where you're just like, there's no surprises? Or like, what's the experience like for you when a movie is completed?
I think it's very interesting. Like when I've been working on something, Get Out's another example of that. I actually went to a couple screenings. I went to one which was this Tastemaker screening that he had a couple weeks before the movie came out, and people were literally jumping up in the front row. Like the entire end of that film, people were it was the most magical thing I had ever seen. And I had actually come for this Q&A at the end, so I only saw like the last two reels. But when, you know, that sort of ending sequence where Chris is escaping happens, I mean, it was wild because it was a Q&A and I saw Daniel, you know, Chris, Daniel Kaluuya, and Jordan like came up to the side and I could just see Daniel going, "Oh my God, I can't believe it. This is happening. And so it was so magical because now Daniel Kaluuya obviously has gone on and he's, you know, he's in Widows, he's in Black Panther. He's like established now. He's going to be the lead in a Melina Matsuka's film that's coming out later this year. I mean, he's on his way, but it was just wild to kind of see him, you know, kind of realize, "Oh my God, nothing's going to be the same."
And
like see that moment.
Well, Ted, I'd like you to know though that the success of Us, as successful $71+ million opening weekend, and I mean, and you know, the box office is still ticking. It might, like, you know, John was saying, it might be second this coming weekend or whatever, but it did beat the next runner up, which was The Nun at $53.8 million opening weekend, over $117.5 million overall.
Yeah. Shout out to Mike Brodner out there who cut one of those trailers. You did a great job, Mike.
I just give Ted a hard time about The Nun because Ted always wants to watch it to the end.
Did he choose to have that title card at the front of the trailer?
Well, oh, you mean like on YouTube?
Watch this to the end. That's an executive, right?
I'm not going to. I'm going to be objective and just be informational here. For my own sake.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there's definitely this thing that's called sort of like the bumper everybody's got a different name for it.
We call it the trailer to the trailer.
Yeah, the trailer to the trailer. So that little 6 second or 2 second or whatever thing that happens at the beginning. I mean, basically, research has shown that retains audiences a lot better, that if you don't have that they'll probably click off sooner. So I mean, I put that in the same phenomenon as everybody says, "Oh my God, we hate it, you know, when you tell us the movie, or like you tell us the whole movie and you spoil the movie in the trailer." I just hate that. But the interesting phenomena is that trailers that do that or have more story or kind of leave less on the table to discover actually create better testing numbers. So it's kind of a like, don't show me that, but all of my viewing habits are going to be, you know, kind of say that you should do that.
Yeah, people have what they say and then people have what they do. And now we have a way to mine into what their habits over what they say their habits are, which is incredibly different at some times.
Yeah, it's like, you know, like you know, when people, you know, say what their favorite book is or their favorite movie is, it's like, yeah, but what's the movie that you watch the most?
Exactly.
The one that you already have seen 100 times.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
And it's not the highbrow, it's usually a guilty pleasure.
Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, most of us have seen Ghostbusters more times than Citizen Kane.
Groundhog Day.
Hey, Groundhog Day is a legitimate classic.
Groundhog Day is a classic. I don't care if people say it's a...
Right.
It is a masterpiece. It really is.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I mean, the thing to kind of piggyback on that too is, so those bumpers or the trailer to the trailers, I mean, that's mostly for things like YouTube or Vimeo or something. I mean,
or social.
Yeah, social media, Instagram, you know, the infinite scroll apps like Facebook and so on. And do you approach, when you're looking at cutting a trailer together, do you approach it differently when you're trying to put something in front of, you know, movies in the theater? theater versus putting them out on YouTube and such?
I will say that one has to consider the digital space, and one has to consider, I mean, specifically in shot selection. I mean, this is an extreme example, but, you know, if you have like a Terrence Malick-esque, you know, beautiful wide shot, you know, where, you know, the people are like pins in the shot, obviously that's not going to play for YouTube.
For a phone.
But by and large, I don't necessarily let it dictate too much of how I tell a story. What happens is, you know, the digital marketing team or other, you know, research or whomever will say, you know, maybe you should consider doing it this way or that way because our research has said this particular editing technique or this particular shot will test better and, you know, retain more viewers. And, you know, that's something that I have to take into account. And it's
right.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the other thing, I guess, that I want to impart about trailers is that just because I'm the editor, it is not an auteur space. Like, there, I mean, not at all. Like, you know, you have the editor, but you have the producer, and then you have, you know, the executive, the client that you're working with, and then you have, and then that client has their boss, and then there's all these other marketing teams. No trailer, at least at a major studio, is the result of one person.
Right. And, you know, neither is a film. Like you said, the film is like the ultimate collaborative piece of art. Collaborative piece of commerce on top of that art. And I would venture to guess, and you can confirm, maybe you can confirm this or tell me I'm wrong, but if you have something like Pacific Rim Uprising, that has an added layer of difficulty or a timeline issue where the visual effects are going to dictate, you know, when you make shot selections or when executives want a certain thing, they're already in the path of, like, you know, finishing these graphics first, these visual effects first, so you kind of have a tighter, narrower rope to walk.
Oh, certainly. I mean, it's just a reality that if you have a movie where most of the movie is green screen or blue screen, that's something you have to take into consideration while you're cutting. And hopefully, you know, you have a team that, you know, is definitely more experienced on the, you know, visual effects pipeline and can, you know, fast track shots. But you have to think about, you know, what's achievable by your deadline. And by the last trailer, you'll have, you know, more on your table.
Unless it's Pirates of the Caribbean. We had TV spots for Pirates of the Caribbean where we are proving stuff with the, you know, with the temp mermaids in it. And by the time the films were, they were starting to ship the film to the theaters, they hadn't finished the people yet. So we had to swap shots at the very last minute.
Oh, whoops. I mean, we have a pretty often detailed, at a certain point when they're like, okay, this is the cut that we want to go with, there'll be a spreadsheet that'll be like, this shot will be done. This shot is questionable. And then they'll have a bunch of other things that like have a little red dot by them. It's like, and it's basically no way in hell you're getting this shot. Like, good luck. This is
don't get your heart set on using that.
This is not happening. And then, you know, that's again, those are battles that I don't have to fight. So I mean, you definitely, it's interesting. The size of the film also dictates kind of how you cut and what you're thinking about, and the point at which you come onto the campaign really, you know, shapes and influences the way you go. I mean, on bigger movies, we'll often be cutting from like the dailies because, you know, there hasn't been enough time, you know, to put together a feature cut. So we will piece as best we can from dailies. And then when a feature comes in, I mean, obviously, you know, we want to go back and make sure that what we like is what the director likes. And then sometimes there's just angles that, you know, for whatever reason, you know, better when you hold on the daily, or our particular take works better for, you know, the trailer. And so that's why sometimes you'll see shots and angles in the trailer that don't necessarily line up with what's in the final feature.
Is that, that's a recent, right? That's like 5 years, but before 5 years, did they, we had a lot of legal and standards and practices issues sometime 7 years ago where they were like, it's not in the movie and it's ending up on these TV spots, you know?
I mean, very early on, there were definitely like dialogue sections that, you know, didn't end up in the movie that we were definitely using. And we also don't always know, you know, what's going to end up in the movie and what's not. I mean, I think the most visible example of that is the deer skeleton in the Get Out trailer. You know, the deer skeleton did not end up in Jordan's final cut. But it was a really, really arresting image that the marketing team felt really strongly needed to be in the trailer. And so it was. And Jordan's been on record as saying he's glad that at least that deer puppeteer, you know, got his due. You know, they didn't just make that maquette for no reason. I think it's like some legendary, you know, visual effects artist, too, that did that. So, like there's no way of knowing if in 5 to 6 months, if a particular shot is still going to be in the movie. I mean, so right. I don't even know how one would regulate that, because I mean, does that mean, you know, if you have it in a piece of advertising, well, come hell or high water, you have to keep that shot in the movie.
No, it was more along the lines of we had that shot and now that shot was cut from the movie. Now we have to do a rolling change on that TV spot.
Interesting.
And maybe TV is different than film. I mean,
it's TV for kids is different. I think the kids aspect was what made us the issue.
I see. Well, I don't actually do a ton of, like, shall we say, younger geared films. So I mean, Pacific Rim is probably as young as I get.
And John, it sounds like you answered one of the questions I wanted to ask you. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure where, like, does the movie finish and then you start cutting the trailer, but it sounds like you're cutting the trailer along the lines of while the movie's being filmed, you're cutting, like you said, from the dailies.
Yes. It depends. Like, well, for example, you know, when I was working on Fruitvale, back when it was Fruitvale, before it was Fruitvale Station, the movie is basically done. But you're also talking, this is like a Sundance movie that doesn't have, you know, a huge marketing budget, as opposed to, you know, if it's the latest Fast movie or the latest Jurassic movie. I mean, yes, as soon as dailies start coming in, you start looking at things. I mean, you start cutting before they're done shooting.
Mm. Wow. Yeah.
You can't wait for months. often, you know, and luckily you'll have things at your disposal, like pre-visualization, or as they call it, pre-vis, where, you know, it's mm-hmm. it's like an animatic of, you know, particularly complex scenes, or you'll have storyboards, or you'll have sometimes what you'll do just as a placeholder, just for presentation, is to actually like steal other movies that those actors have been in. Like if you need a shot of, you know, Chris Pratt or Jason Statham, you know, you'll just go over to one of their other movies and be like, it's going to be a shot kind of like this. And of course that never sees the light of day in the world, but it just, I mean, the marketing team, I mean, you're basically in a race against the clock to maximize the commercial potential of this giant 9-figure investment. So you're not going to wait months to figure out if something's working or not.
Yeah. And as one who edits trailers together, are you like hypercritical of trailers when you're watching movies things? Or?
Oh, hell yeah.
Like, what were they thinking?
You can't turn it off.
I am so harsh, and you know, I love watching trailers with my wife, because I'll just be watching something that I think is just an absolute train wreck, and you know.
And she loves it.
Well, and she'll look over me and is like, we're going to see that. You know that, right? I'm like, all right. Well, I got, you know,
How often is the trailer going to destroy the movie for you?
A good litmus test. Yeah.
Or is the movie typically better than what you expected?
Oh, well, no, I mean, it depends. I mean, there's some movies that I've been, I mean, just aghast at their marketing campaigns, and then the movie surprises me. And then there's been movies where I've been like, wow, that was a masterful piece of marketing. They must really have something to work with there. And then, you know, you go see the movie and you come to find out, wow, that marketing team really did its job, because there is nothing here. I've been in this long enough to realize that you can't truly judge any piece of art from how it's presented and its marketing. And if things get spoiled for you, yeah, it sucks, but you have to basically approach every movie as if it's the first time you've seen any materials from it to like objectively enjoy it as like either a piece of art or just as a piece of entertainment. So I kind of like to throw the expectations out the window. Obviously, you know, sometimes you're going to be disappointed. Like when I saw 300, I was just really like, I thought the movie was a visual masterpiece, but I was like, where's that Nine Inch Nails song? That Nine Inch Nails song was so good. I want to see a fight to that song. And you know, so when I walked out of the theater, I was kind of like, I mean, that looked pretty cool, but
let's cue up the trailer and watch the trailer again.
This trailer's getting me so hype, and the movie was good, but this trailer just took me to like, and you know, that's also when you realize the power of this job is that certain movies and certain experiences just distill down better to 2.5 minutes than they do to 2 hours.
Well, it's so funny you say that, because last night when I was watching Us, the first time they're in the car together, they don't play I Got Five on it, you know, so it was like, is that a bait and switch there? And then later on in the movie, they do play it, and I'm like, oh, thank God it's in the movie.
But at least it's Janelle Monáe, and you'd be hard pressed to find a better first song. But I mean, yeah, it's always fun, because you know, when you see the trailer, you kind of form this internal narrative about what this movie is going to be. And what's interesting, you know, is how far can you push it without audiences, you know, basically rejecting the film.
Right.
So John, how did you get to come to do what you do?
I actually went to Florida State, as did a former guest of your show, Marcos Gabriel.
And everybody else at Soapbox, too.
Oh, God. Come on. Yeah. Well, I wasn't there at Soapbox. I was there at a place called Toybox, where he was a producer, creative director. So I was unsure of what to do after I graduated. I came out here. I crashed on the couch of somebody who was a grip on Desperate Housewives. And I was like, oh, that sounds like a great, you know, man, I'd love to get on set and, you know, be on a real TV set. And then my professor was like, just so you know, there's this other guy that works in trailers. I'm like, trailers, whatever. And then of course, the Desperate Housewives gig just never really panned out. So I was like, okay, well, I guess I'll go be a runner at this trailer company. And fast forward, you know, 2 years later, I'm basically a junior editor banging out TV spots for this Clive Owen movie called Shoot 'Em Up, which was not a box office success, but I mean, it was basically a John Woo inspired action film.
It was a fun flick. I remember that movie.
Oh, it's so fun. It's definitely the lesser of the Clive Owen Saves a Baby movies, but I mean, it does not hold a candle to Children of Men, admittedly. You know, when you're like a 22, 23 year old and you're just cutting these crazy 30 second spots, it's heaven. And then I just kept at it and eventually started finishing a couple trailers, bringing my skills as a musician to the table, started composing a little bit and then mixing that in. I mean,
so do you have like a home studio where you do your own like personal work to kind of scratch that creative itch and everything, or?
Kind of, but most of what I do is I just have a keyboard at work, and then I've got, you know, Logic on my laptop, and and then sometimes I'll hash out ideas there. Sometimes I'll hash out ideas at home, and I'll play around with things, and then, you know, I'll just you know, put them on a flash drive and bring them over to the server and you know, see what sticks.
And then, you know, just briefly, what are the tools that you use when you're doing trailers and things? You know, you're on like what, Adobe Audition or Premiere or something, or?
So I cut both at home and at work, and at home I do Premiere, and at work I do Avid.
Oh, okay.
So I like to stay bilingual, at least.
Yeah.
At least as an editor.
You have to, right?
I guess overall, though, I mean, you've been doing this for what, about a decade now or so? I mean, because I didn't realize, like, Florida State was such a huge, I don't know, like, film school or something. Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is I didn't even come from the film school. I mean, fun fact, I actually, my last 2 years, applied to go to graduate school there and got rejected both times, which, funny enough, I think actually turned out to be the best thing that ever will never happen to me, because I mean, I would have probably just been, you know, still trying to pay off that debt.
So what is your undergrad degree in then?
So my undergrad, in the same grad that Marcos had, is we were in the College of Communications, and we were in the media production department, and the department's changed names now, but it was basically, I mean, I joke that it was film school without all the toys. So I was going to school from like, you know, 01 to 05. life. So this is very much in the time when digital cinema was really taking hold. I mean, we were working with, you know, mini DV tapes and then like,
right.
you know, starting to play with 24p that made everything look like film and, you know, came up on Avids. But it was a really exciting time because you saw that digital cinema was even starting to enter the multiplex. And this is right before Reds. This is right before
the Phantom, right?
The Phantom, before, you know, Michael Mann started using the Viper on everything. So, I mean, the possibilities kind of seemed endless. And it was sort of this interesting thing that, you know, being an editor at the film school and being an editor at, you know, in the media production department, I mean, what's the difference really? And so I learned the skill set for my job, you know, without, you know, having to take that extra 2 or 3 years of school. And editing was always something that really made sense to me because before I got into editing, I would make beats and I'd, you know, compositions in, you know, whether it was GarageBand or Acid Music or, you know, whatever tool I had at the time. I learned really early on to think from, you know, A to B. And all editing, specifically trailer editing, is basically doing that, but with pictures. And so my philosophy when I cut is it's very much like composing a song. And, you know, you have to have dynamics and movements and, you know, it's not the same as, you know, verse, chorus, but there is a rhythm that any good piece should have. And, you know, just like genres of music, every genre kind of tweaks the form a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, as the editor of Trailer Junkies podcast, I know exactly what you're talking about.
So over all the years that you've been doing this, the idea of how the editor fits into this overall process has changed quite a bit. You know, they used to be called what, Trailer Monkeys back in the day, right? It was totally like a throwaway kind of thing, right?
Before 2005, I have no idea what they were called.
And then there's the evolution of the Predator. And then, you know, you have all the post houses and now we're doing a lot more hybrid in-house and out-of-house. Do you have any ideas on how that has changed over your career?
You mean like the producer-editor relationship and then the evolution to a Predator? I do. I think it's a very case-by-case, professional-by-professional basis. I think there are, you know, basically one-man bands out there. They tend to work at smaller shops. Some of them work at bigger shops, but I think there has always been a natural bifurcation of the professional that kind of gets into the trenches and gets into all the material and, you know, looks for all the best stuff and figures out, you know, new editorial techniques. And then basically somebody who has a 30,000 feet from above view, who's the liaison to the client. And obviously, you know, the latter is the producer and the former is the editor. And it's a very different skill set. And there's very few people who can do both at the same time. Now, what does happen, and I think happens more often now, just because, you know, there's more editors and the technology, you know, and all other sorts of factors, is that clients will often have very tight relationships with certain editors that they'll just have like a shorthand. So the producer doesn't always necessarily need to be there and the client will interface directly with an editor. So technically the editor at that point is a predator. I mean, I look at all these definitions is very fluid. It's kind of my perspective. And that's the case in my job. There's certain folks that, especially being at Universal, they can just come down to my bay, hang out, and, you know, we can bang something out. And then there's others, you know, that it's a very structured, okay, they go to the producers and then the producers come to me. And both of those working, you know, workflows have their place.
Right. You get paper cut sometimes, and then sometimes you just...
Yeah, I will say this. As the years have gone by, I get less and less paper cuts. And I don't know if that's necessarily just a trust in my editorial abilities or if that's just we have so many damn things. There's so many more pieces of advertising that go on now between digital and, you know, TV and to say nothing of the trailers, that there's just not the time to paper cut every single little piece of advertising, which, you know, is kind of a good thing when you want creative freedom and kind of a bad thing when you're stuck.
Before we get down the rabbit hole of, you know, the In a World version of trailers. What do you guys say we talk about Lucy in the Sky for tonight? And you can see what it's like to actually be a trailer junkie, even though you cut trailers together for a living.
Oh, yeah. Well, you have to be a trailer junkie as a trailer editor.
Oh, I couldn't imagine. Sure.
If you don't love this stuff, you'll go crazy.
I bet. I guess one last question, though. So my cousin works at Warner Brothers. He befriended a lot of the sound guys and everything. And when you look at the sound editing booths, there are these little booths where it's like a computer screen, a couple of speakers, and these guys are in these like tiny closets. That's not the world that you live in, is like these tiny little booths, is it?
Not anymore. I mean, when you're a junior editor, you'll cut wherever they'll give you room to. But I've had a pretty nice office for the past
going on 10 years or so. Cool.
But what's funny is there are shops where they'll basically have a closet, and that's where they do like temp VO and stuff. So you'll literally go into this closet under the stairs, and then you'll be like, this Friday, you know, summer heats up, and you know, and then you'll just be talking in the hallway, and then a door will just open. Shut up! I'm trying to record here.
Like, there's no red light saying, like, the recording's going and all this? No,
I mean, not every trailer shot. I mean, at the studios, sure. Yeah, there'll be, like, a little recording light. Or you know, when you go to the mix stages and then the sound stages where the actual actor will come in to, you know, do ADR or whatever. Yes, you'll have that. But at a lot of places, you know, their recording booths very often are just like just some room or, you know, a closet or whatever. It's a lot more. You don't need all the, you know, bells and whistles, you know, when it comes down to, you know, just getting something done.
Yeah, yeah. So Lucy in the Sky, John, how about we start with you? And you did make a comment that you haven't seen the shifting aspect ratio the way you have in this trailer.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing. I mean, the aspect ratio, and I'm not an aspect connoisseur, but it does kind of look like it goes from 1.66 to 2.35, and it goes from really widescreen to basically, you know, what you would see on your TV,
like a 16:9 or something.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and I've noticed that all the stuff that was in like the, you know, the tighter aspect ratio is kind of when she is. So do you want to tee up the trailer at all before I get into all the tech?
I would say go for it, and then we could just guide our listeners to go watch the trailer at some point when they feel they need to.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah,
sweet.
We just assume everybody's seen the trailer and maybe seen it right before this, or if they hear us talking about something, then they'll stop this and then watch the trailer and then come back.
Perfect.
So let's hand off the baton and you just take off running.
So yeah, one of the things, as you were saying, that really intrigued me was the shifting aspect ratio, how it goes from like sort of a 16:9 to like a more like 2.35. It goes from basically your TV to like some David Lean-esque epic. And what's really kind of cool about that is that I noticed that whenever she's kind of in her everyday life or back on Earth during the mundane is when it goes 16:9. And then when she's in space or when she's having one of these like fantastic, you know, dream sequences or hallucinations, who knows what they are. It's a Noah Hawley film, so who can tell? Yeah, but it goes to 2.35. And I just thought that was a really wild technique that I had never seen in anything other than student films, where you're basically playing with every filter that you in aspect ratio that you can, because you can,
and no one's judging you for it.
No, they're like, oh my god, he's a genius,
right?
Yeah, and I got the sense that the aspect ratios are changing as the various moments when she's tripping on acid, you know. So like as she's tripping, that the aspect ratio changes, and I don't know to which one it is, but and then as she like comes back to, you know, reality, then it kind of goes back to the aspect ratio of whatever the movie is going to be showing you for, you know, it's normal viewing, I guess, for what it is for that movie.
Is she actually on drugs? Is that why they call it Lucy in the Sky?
I have no idea. That was my assumption.
That she's just on drugs.
And then the end with the little piano riff, the end kind of implies that, I think.
No, they finally bring the song in. You can't have the title and not bring some of the elements of the song into it.
But the song's about acid.
You were mentioning that, you know, the shifting aspect ratios. It's like one's like when she's on acid or not. I thought she was just sort of like once she got back to Earth, that she's like disconnected from reality because it's not as real as space was.
I gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, and I think there's a vastness of space that makes sense when you're in that 2-3-5 environment. It feels bigger than your field of vision, you know, or right at the edges of your field of vision. And when she came back, I think it might have been my mind playing tricks on me or me misremembering, but it felt like it was actually something that sometimes it's switched between them, but there are other times where it definitely was like squeezing in on you. So there is this anxiety and anxiety laden moments in the trailer that definitely put you in a place of hopefully understanding the character a little more.
Otherwise too, I kind of had the feeling like with Homecoming, when it was like in the past versus the present, and they went from the widescreen to the square,
yeah,
and back and forth, you know, it kind of gave me that sense too. Like if it's not where she's high versus sober, it might be where, like you said, space versus Earth or something of that nature, like, you know, whatever that juxtaposition is.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was an incredibly, it's very easy sometimes for art to kind of get in the way of telling a story. And I think, you know, this confusion very often, like that we're talking, like as we're interpreting this, kind of speaks to that sometimes. It's like, what's more important, like imparting a feeling or imparting a story? And I think this is one of those movies where it's more about the former, which is like, God, I want to know what this is about. Because it's not 100% clear what Natalie Portman's character is going through.
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
And John, like when you're cutting trailers together, mm-hmm. and let's consider Lucy in the Sky, I mean, this is like really non-linear. And then sometimes trailers are very linear where they just kind of start in the beginning, A to B to C to D, and then this trailer ends, where this one is just like jump cutting all over the place. What do you enjoy in trailers? Do you enjoy the jump cuts all over, or do you like linear stories? What's your opinion?
I think every I'm sorry, this is such a non-committal answer, but but every movie kind of calls for a different kind of technique. I think you'll find very often that bigger blockbusters, there's the tendency to go more linear, and then for smaller art films, there's this tendency that you want to just get around the movie and impart kind of the biggest canvas, and that may not necessarily be an A to B to C plot line.
Mm.
Right.
I like coming away from a trailer, A, being like moved to something, whether it's, you know, whether it's excitement, whether it's, you know, beauty. I mean, my favorite trailer that I've seen this year has been this A24 release called The Last Black Man in San Francisco.
Yeah, we talked about it last week.
Oh, we did.
Oh,
that
really?
Last week.
Yeah. Wow. I didn't catch up with I'm a little behind.
That's okay. Cool. I'm glad that you liked it.
It's so beautiful. And then that cover, you know, of If You're Going to San Francisco just breaks your heart in the middle of that thing.
Sure thing. Yeah.
I mean, and you know, on its surface, if you tell that story A to B to C, I mean, it's a story about displacement and gentrification. And wow, that doesn't sound like a fun time at the movies. But when you see it through the lens of art and through, you know, just that wonderful, like those slow moving, you know, tracking shots and slow-mo, and, you know, artfully done as only the Mark Wallen people that were behind it do, you know, that's kind of their bread and butter, is like things that make you want to cry. I mean, there's just nothing like it. And there's nothing that telling that story linearly would buy you.
But I think it's funny that you say that, because like a movie can break your heart and be a great movie. But if a trailer about a movie that's going to break your heart, it has to sell hope.
Yeah.
It has to sell you on the idea of, at the end, the uplift in the trailer has to be the misdirect. You can't, you know, you can kill somebody in a movie, but don't kill them in the trailer, because then there's no reason to go see the movie.
Yeah. Million Dollar Baby is like the most classic example of that. It's like where people thought they were going to go see Rocky, and they ended up seeing... They ended up seeing basically
Old Yeller.
Yeah, exactly. I was literally about to say Old Yeller.
Yeah, hilarious.
Yeah.
There's some, like, and Ted and I talk about this a lot, like, you know, there's a lot of movie genres that have a formula. So, and I think, like, the Marvel movies, you know, there's, like, a formula to them. You know, the guy wants to blow up the world, here comes the superheroes, you know, the battles go.
And what we talk about, it's very safe. And I think what, when you're talking about blockbusters being linear, I think those are safe bets, and you know that people are going to go see the movie, and you just don't want to confuse the audience because you have a very wide four quadrant movie that you're trying to hit everybody. So I think it's more about safety and not alienating people.
There's definitely a simplicity that I don't think, I mean, the biggest rule in this town is if it's not broke, don't fix it. And I mean, until it just gets so redundant that it becomes almost a parody of itself, which the lack of innovation becomes a problem. And then in that environment, you get something like Guardians of the Galaxy, where it takes a formula, but so inverts it. That it feels brand new and fresh, even though it's basically the same story. I think what's interesting, and you know, even on Us and Get Out, I'm not like, we didn't reinvent the wheel. We just kind of tilted it a few degrees. It still has the basic structure of any horror trailer. Like, everything's fine until it's not. Things are creepy. Now they're gonna get super crazy.
Right. Oh, I mean, the Us trailer was really amazing. I mean, as I watched it, and then you're just like, what are the rabbits? What does that mean? You know?
Yeah.
And to this day, I don't really fully understand the rabbits.
Yeah.
I have a theory.
Oh,
I have
a
theory on the rabbits, but you know. Are we in spoiler land? We're over an hour, so we can do spoilers now, right, Jimmy?
Oh, yeah. You know, if anybody doesn't, I mean, just turn this off, go watch the movie, come back. If you're that worried about it.
Yeah, there's spoilers now.
So what do you think? The do you want your theory or you want my theory for the rabbits?
Why don't you shoot first?
Okay, I'll shoot first since I saw it yesterday.
I think, Ted, you should go first because, okay. You know, John probably knows something we don't know.
Okay, so my theory on the rabbits is that since it was genetic testing on tethering the tethered twins in the human world, that they used the rabbits to test because their life cycles were faster. And then when they abandoned the test, they expected everyone to die, but because of rabbits' proficiency in procreation,
they ovulate upon intercourse.
Thank you. They were able to sustain this meat, these meat people.
Yeah,
sure.
What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that is definitely a theory I've heard bandied around, and like, yeah, I mean, it definitely makes sense. I think I have just sort of chosen to look at more of the metaphorical reasons of the rabbits. And, you know, when I think of that, it's more of like, what does the rabbit symbolize? The rabbit symbolizes spring, which is new birth.
Yeah.
And what they are is they're birthing like a revolution, literally. That's kind of where I took them, is this idea of, you know, just constant regeneration and renewal. And usually you associate that with happiness and positivity.
Yeah.
I think I read somewhere, I can't verify this, that Jordan's kind of creeped out by rabbits. That he like, I think he had like a pet one or something, but then he's also like kind of just finds them slightly sinister.
Yeah. They got red eyes. Come on.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think that's the other thing, is that there's just certain things that beyond the symbolism or whatever of them, it's just that they just feel something off that disturbs you. And I think Jordan's a master of just finding those little things. You know, I mean, obviously scissors have, you know, a connotation in this movie about like, you know, untethering and so forth. But it's also just really creepy. Like, there's something about it, and there's just something unnerving. And I'm of the belief that even with all the symbolism, that not all of it has to mean completely make sense and mean everything, that just the fact that it gets under your skin is enough.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think it was a very personal statement. And I think that's why a lot of this is left unexplained. One of my coworkers I was talking to today about it, he said, you know, I always want a movie to at least meet me halfway. You know, everyone says like, oh, if the movie gives you everything on a platter, then it's not trusting the audience. And then at first, first, he thought maybe this movie didn't even feel like it met him halfway. And I said, I think the reason it doesn't feel like it meets you halfway is because it is a very personal movie that you have to put yourself into the situation before you get anything out of the movie. And that's why the more and more I put myself into the idea of living in that space, I mean, the body count on this thing jumps from 3 dead to half the people dead in a matter of minutes.
It's funny because my mom was like asking me, she's like, because, you know, she doesn't like horror movies, but I told her, it's like, you got to watch Get Out, Mom. And then she saw Us and she was like, I have to tell you, your trailers creep me out so much. I don't know if I want to go. But she's like, is it gross? Like, is it violent? It's like,
your mom sounds like my mom.
Oh, it totally, it's every, well, it's a Midwestern mom. It's like, is it gross? I'm like, if you could take Get Out, you can take this.
Yeah.
It's so funny because, you know, to reference Jaws, I mean, like, this is the generation that grew up with Jaws. And it's like, it's no worse than Jaws. You'll be fine.
No.
Yeah.
This is a thriller horror for sure. It's not a gore horror. It's not Eli Roth. You know, it's a thriller, and it is psychological. And to me, there are a couple of thoughts on it, and I'm sorry to go long on this, but I do love this movie. So my two big thoughts on it are, so Jordan Peele is now doing this, and Quentin Tarantino does this, where when we talked about last week, we also talked about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and it's such a respect and a knowledge about genre that when they do the genre movie, it's not the way that Scream kind of thumb their nose at the genre and like, we know the genre, so we're gonna parody it, but we're gonna parody it so well that it is actually a hyper genre. This is just a hyper real, hyper deep genre movie where we know so much about it that we're gonna show Chud in here, we're gonna show you Jaws, we're gonna take every opportunity and do a genre nod, an Easter egg to something within the genre. I mean, even standing at the end of the street is like, I've never seen any of the Halloween movies, but to me, that's a Halloween trope, that Halloween stake.
Oh, that's like Michael Myers standing at the, yeah.
Where they're standing at the top of the driveway kind of thing.
Sure. Yeah.
In the shadow. Sure. So I love that. And then my big thought on the overall conceptual part of it was, you bury things to kill them, right? You can bury the dead, but you also bury seeds, and out of the buried seeds comes life, you know? So it's like they meant to bury the dead, you know, but they actually ended up burying this growth that actually destroyed the whole world. And in and of itself, it was never going to do that, but only the impetus of this one. Now, Jimmy's never going to see this, I think, or he won't care about this spoiler, but that one switch of the two little girls, I think that is, to me, the impetus between the whole thing. And it's that's the hiding of yourself. Did you bury yourself? And if you bury yourself, your true self will always come through. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
So in other words, so like suppressing your emotions or your personality, but yet you still can't suppress it enough to where like your true self comes out to the people that are most meaningful to you or something.
So I want to talk about the one thing about this movie that I do want to talk about, that I thought a lot more people would kind of catch up on and like think pieces or whatever, is I think Jordan's been very forthright that, you know, this movie is basically his reaction to where we are at as a country, and that Us, you know, also stands for US, right?
Right.
Right. Yeah.
And the little girl says we're America, right? Or
of course, says we're Americans. Yeah.
America.
Yeah. We're Americans. Like, yeah. But I think the most striking image to me is the funhouse. So when she goes in, and this actually isn't spoiling anything, is that when she goes in as a little girl, it's this, you know, Native, very stereotypical Native American chieftain who's pointing at you to, you know, it's called Vision Quest. And right. it's very...
Find yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, find yourself, right? And it's just kind of like, you know, old school, inappropriate Native American imagery.
Yeah.
But then they go back, and what does that funhouse become?
A Merlin, right?
Exactly. It becomes like a Merlin's Woods.
Yeah.
And to me,
that fits into the grander metaphor about this movie, which is that, you know, we are literally a country built on death, built on, you know, killing, you know, the first peoples, not all of them. I mean, there are still, you know, generations that are still here, but there is this very fundamental fact of our birth as a country that I think we're still grappling with, and other traumatic events like that, that we're still kind of coming to grips with. And there's
the Trail of Tears and all that kind of stuff.
Of course, yeah. Of course. Yeah. And I think that there's other micro examples of that, but that particular instance to me, this idea that you kind of leave behind your traumatic history to take on this new identity, to take on a new family, to you know, go to the beach, go to a beach house, get a boat, you know, become the all-American dream, that there's still fundamentally things, regardless of where you come from, regardless of politics, religion, or whatever, that you still deep down have to deal with, that you have to look at, find yourself and watch yourself. And you know, I'm kind of surprised that more people haven't picked up on that particular little thing, because to me, that little instance to me encapsulates the entire movie for me.
And it is something, like you said, they had done that to that generation, and now it's being reaped upon them. And I think, even though this what is it, Jeremiah 11:11, right? Everybody in the world is looking this thing up. It's, I will bring on them a disaster they cannot escape. Although they cry out to me, I will not listen to them. So this is like, this is the line, right? This is the, that's the thing.
Y'all want to be freaked out by something?
Please.
Guess what my birthday is.
Not today.
No way. No. It's November 11th.
11/11.
Yeah.
11/11 is a theme in us. And also, when they do they're doing rock, paper, scissors, they tie on scissors, and that's two. It's 11, one and one and one and one, and it's also scissors. So it's like, it's doubly thematic, because the scissors are such a theme, and then also the...
So here's the freaky thing. Not only was I born on November 11th, but 9 years before, my sister was born on November 11th.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Your parents are consistent.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so.
You have a lot of 11/11 going on in your
well
life.
Laid plans.
So when I first saw this movie, it freaked me out on just another level. So
on a personal level.
What would numerologists say about this? So really quick, how did your guys' beer finish up? Was it pretty good, or is it warm and everything?
Shoot. Here, let me go attend to that real quick.
Yeah, mine definitely got boozier as it got warmer. Yeah, it was like as if I was drinking, like, I don't know, some sort of like a chocolatey scotch or something.
Like a liquor, like a scotch ale or something, right?
Almost, yeah. I mean, it was like it just started to get like boozier. I mean, as it warmed.
Mine got a little bitter right at the end, but I finished mine a good half an hour ago. So.
I saw that.
I've barely been sipping on mine, so it's really good though. I really do like it, but I think I'm gonna have to report back. It's
okay.
It's finishing fine, but I think I have to give it a few more samples.
Yeah, and I also wanted to before we finish up, I wanted to say that we'll put your there's a couple of links that we'll have on our website in the show notes that lead to the Gray Lady for article that mentions John in there, and also just some information about opening weekend and some of the other things that we'll share.
Awesome.
Cool.
Yeah. You know, just promote things a little bit more. And, you know, I'm sure, let's put it this way. I'm sure everybody who knows about our podcast and what they're listening to also knows about the movie, but hey, it might be some of those like added seeds that they'll enjoy listening to or reading about or whatever before they go see the movie.
They can listen to our podcast as they read the think pieces out there on this.
On the drive to the theater.
hopefully on the way back.
There you go. Perfect.
Well, on the way there to see what it's like to cut the trailer on the way back to have the talk. Yeah.
Hopefully they'll pause at like an hour and change in.
Exactly. Exactly.
There you go.
Yeah. Are you going to go see the movie?
Oh, I plan to. Yeah. Yeah. You know, where I live, I live Lompoc, California, north of Santa Barbara. So it's just hard to get to the theater from where I live because we don't, you know, we're a little town, you know, kind of rural. We don't have a lot of stuff here, you know, unfortunately. All right, John. Hey, it was a pleasure, man. It was you know, great talking with you, and we appreciate you coming on our show. And awesome things to talk about.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for doing this. I mean, I do have to say, our little niche of the industry is not one that gets a lot of a spotlight. Even though everybody watches our work, very few people talk about what we do. That part of that's on purpose. But I mean, we really appreciate any and every shout out that we can get.
Awesome. Well, then in your community, definitely let your friends know, and we're open to other interviews.
I could see if I could refer you to a few people.
There you go.
Yeah, I don't know who else would be like just a great interview. I mean, I hate to say, there's a reason that they stick most of us in base, because we could just go on and on without any point. Like we need an editor ourselves. But if there's any particular trailers or folks that you'd be interested in talking to, I mean, I can kind of, you know, ring some bells and so forth.
Yeah, cool.
I mean, I'm of the opinion everybody has a story, you know? I mean,
certainly.
You guys all got to, I mean, all of us, we got to where we are in some way or another. But you know what? And I think you're completely right in that, you know, it's such an unsung industry or niche of the industry, yet everybody watches trailers before they go to the movies.
Yeah, I got to say, the fact that I got shouted out by name in the New York Times,
that was amazing.
That doesn't happen. Like the only other editor that I can think of that's ever gotten any press whatsoever is the great Bill Neal. He like did like, you know, Sunday morning like 4 or 5 years ago, and he's like the greatest. I think Marco's talked about him. He's like the godfather of horror trailers.
Oh yeah.
Attention to us as professionals just very rarely happens. we have the golden trailers and the key arts, and we all like pat each other on the back and, you know, pretend like people know what we do.
Well, you're special people in our world, so.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. We're our own little tribe.
All right.
Awesome.
All right, John. Well, hey, thanks again, man. It was great having you.
Thanks, John.
Thank you so much. It was a lot of fun. And thanks for the beer.
All right, you have a good night.
Yeah, talk to you later.
Next week, join Jim and Ted as they disarm another Hollywood bomb or marketing masterpiece. Remember, the Holy Trinity of podcasting. Subscribe, like, share.
Special thanks to Jeremy Kent Jackson for the voiceover and Rahelio for the music.